Prime time is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Always correct, as long as you're not talking political correctness. Bob McCowan in Primetime Sports. Now on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hour three of Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. McCowan and Brunt. Jerry Sullivan of the Buffalo News. Buck Martinez of Sportsnet a little bit later on. And the executive director of the NHLPA, Don Fehr, will join us in just a few minutes. Just a slight response to our conversation with the commissioner, Mr. Bettman. We talked about Las Vegas. I made mention of the fact that you're in competition for the entertainment dollar in Las Vegas, which is unquestioned. It's, you know, if it's not the entertainment capital of the world, it's pretty close. And the suggestion has come in that, you know, locals in Las Vegas don't go to the Strip, which is actually true. If they're inclined to go to a casino, they'll go to what are known as local casinos or suburban casinos. But the competition for the entertainment dollar in a place like Las Vegas, even Gary would admit and alluded to the fact that a significant portion of the ticket-buying public in a place like Vegas would be tourists, would be people that are in town. There are well over 100,000 people in town, visitors in town, at any given time, and you're going to try to appeal to that group. And they're only usually there for 3 days or three nights, and they got lots of things they want to get done while they're there. So that was my reference point.
But the question I would ask about that is, you know, and I understand they're having their ticket drive, and it's, you know, they're just going to wait and see. And they, you know, they did that in Winnipeg after they pretty much decided the team was going to go there anyway. And they did it, and Jim Balsley did it in Hamilton, but they didn't want to go to Hamilton, so it didn't matter how many he sold. But what would be the history of these guys, or any league actually, authorizing a ticket drive to test the marketplace and doing a U-turn and saying we don't want to go there, even though you have the money to buy a team?
It's a great question.
It's never happened, I can tell you. So if the guy has the money, he'll get a team
and wants the team.
Yeah, he wants the team.
But I would say this:
I guess he could get scared off. But I think once you start going down that road, Bob, no one's ever turned around.
Well, we'll talk to Don Fehr about it because he's on the line now. But I will say this much: I would say that the ticket drive is already a failure in Las Vegas. I think if you've only got 7,000 two or three weeks after you started the ticket drive,
yeah, it's not great.
You've already failed to achieve it.
And again, it may scare the guy from spending whatever the number is that they want him to spend.
It would scare me if I was him.
But if he still wants the team and his check clears and he has an arena, it'd be a rare league that would turn their back on a guy like that.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, I think it's a valid point. Here's the executive director of the NHLPA, Don Fehr. Mr. Fehr, how are you?
I'm well. Please call me Don.
Okay. We were just talking about Vegas, and I didn't necessarily want to start this conversation or even necessarily address it. But I think would you concur that at 7,000 pledges several weeks into the campaign, at the very least, it's an underwhelming response in Las Vegas?
Not yet. And the reason I say that is basically this. They're doing the campaign. They have their timelines. They had certain expectations, and the campaign isn't over yet. And I have learned from long experience that judgments made midstream, even if it's past halfway midstream, are likely to turn out to be wrong as often as right. So we'll know the answer to that in due course, but at this point, I wouldn't rush to judgment on it.
Do you have a personal feeling about what will happen in Las Vegas?
Meaning, will there be an expansion team eventually awarded?
Yep.
Not really. I expect a couple of things. If the drive is ultimately successful and the ownership group wants to make a real run at it, I assume that the NHL will listen hard to them. I have no reason to believe that any commitments have been made, even on a contingent basis, and they'll look. And the first responsibility to determine the location of teams and the number of teams, which is what expansion comes down to, rests with the league. If it's something that they're treating seriously, we'll look at it. To the extent we have opinions, we'll get into it with them. From the player's standpoint, there's obviously two things going on. Balance would be better served with 32 teams rather than 30. Mm-hmm. And every extra team you have are extra jobs, and those matter to players.
Do you have an opinion on whether, from a we talked a fair bit with Mr. Bettman about the geography of the National Hockey League, and that right now, probably if you looked at the most likely places to go, and it's two teams, hard to see turning Quebec down. And if Vegas is the other one, you got one west, one east, the preference probably would be two in the west. Do you have an opinion on that?
I go at it a little differently. I suppose in a perfect world, if you could have two in the west, that solves the problem. You don't have to worry about divisional realignment or anything
Correct.
Else. But if the best two markets turn out to be Quebec and Seattle or Las Vegas or somewhere else, and that's where you want to go, then that's where you go, and you have discussions about rearranging the divisions effectively in that scenario to move a team that's now in the east to the west. It's not the easiest thing to do, but it's not intrinsically unsolvable either.
We were obviously today's. We were talking a lot of World Cup with the Commissioner Don, and one of the things I asked him early in the conversation. You know, we're coming up on 40 years. Well, this World Cup will come 40 years from the first after the first Canada Cup, and I asked him why it didn't stick. You know, there were Canada Cups, there were World Cups, there's a lot of great hockey played, but it didn't. It never really got established. And he essentially said it was union problems. You know, the changes in union leadership. I'm going to pause so people can hear you laughing. Go ahead.
Okay. That's not what I expected. All I can tell you is this. I don't know what the discussions were during all of those years. I don't know what the holdup was. I don't know why there wasn't a World Cup 4 years after 96. Wasn't here, had other fish to fry down at my old job with baseball. But I can tell you this, that we approach this on the NHLPA side, and I believe the NHL is approaching it on their side in the following way, and maybe this is a fundamentally different kind of approach. We want to find a way to agree upon and then commit to a long-term, regular, recurring series of international events, which would include World Cups, could well include a series of other things, and really try and elevate hockey globally and develop markets that we think we ought to have a good chance to have a big presence in. And if what Gary means is that he thinks the union is constituted, knows how is to be able to do that, that's great. If it just was never approached that way before, but we're going to do it right now, that's great too. I can't really speak to what happened in the past.
What other, you mentioned, so other international events, what are we talking about then, Don?
I think there'll be some discussions about whether or not we play more in-season games in Europe and perhaps in a different format than the premier games which kick off the season. There have been discussion about informal at this stage about various types of all-star formats. We've sort of been using a Ryder Cup type format as a euphemism for that. There are ideas floating around, you know, maybe eventually, although this is way down the road, you could get club versus club championship competitions of some sort or another. And the trick is to develop a recurring series of events which highlights the game, highlights the NHL and the best players, begins to make real inroads into raising the economic basis of European hockey to North American levels, and really pushes hockey to a higher place, not only on the global stage, but also in North America, so that it really is looked at in the same breath as baseball, football, and basketball.
Is that compatible?
I think we can do that.
Is that compatible with remaining in the Olympic Games?
Yes, I think it is.
Okay, so tell me how that works, because I know your players want to stay in the Olympic Games, but tell me how that works.
There's no question that if we can get the appropriate agreements, and you know, there's a lot that goes into that, but if we can, as we have in the past, then the players are very much going to want to play. But, you know, when you look at it, what you would do is essentially say, if you're going to do this, and we aren't there yet, that you're going to incorporate the Olympic Games into this regular recurring calendar.
With Don Fehr, the executive director of the NHL Players Association, one of the things that I'm not thrilled about in this new World Cup, let me start by saying I'm very happy the World Cup is back. I think it's long overdue. I'm looking forward to it. I think most hockey fans, all hockey fans, are. The part of this equation that kind of leaves me cold is these last two teams. And it just occurs to me that the agenda here is to get as many NHL players into this tournament as we possibly can. And the way to do that is to create a team, a team of others, and an under 23 squad, where they're, and I understand the time is tight, but I think there were other mechanisms that you could have put in place if you have to have an 8-team tournament rather than a 6-team tournament to get two other countries in there. Will they be competitive? Maybe not, but you know, you go to a World Cup of soccer or a World Cup of anything, there are always underdogs, invariably. Am I wrong in that assessment? Was the NHLPA a key participant factor in determining who those last two teams would be?
Well, let me take that on several levels. First, to your last question, yes. We're doing this jointly with the NHL, and we have to get agreement on all issues and then get agreement from the various other partners we're going to have working with us, whether it's the European Federations, the IIHF, broadcast networks, or so on. So the answer to that is of course, yes. Secondly, we approach this in the following way. One of the things we want to do with this tournament is make a statement. We want to make a statement that we're here to stay. We're here to stay on the world stage, and we can create the most competitive hockey tournament ever played. And that goes directly to your question about maybe the last two teams would not have been all that strong, but they're of course underdogs. It is true, though, that when I go and talk to my members and they look at it, you have all kinds of players who could conceivably be in this tournament that are great players that simply would not be. And there's a fundamental question as to whether, for purposes of having the best players in the world there and for getting into more markets in Europe and getting exposure, you want to do that. I mean, to take the most obvious example of all, you know, how long would it be before Slovenia was in a tournament? Yet they have a player mm-hmm. that a lot of people think is the equal of anybody out there that certainly would play in this tournament. So you look at it from that standpoint. And when you put all that together, the conclusion was we didn't have a lot of time. There were a lot of other things on the calendar. We want to make the statement. We want it on NHL ice with NHL rules. We want to do it in a destination venue to create that kind of an atmosphere that we think will be very helpful for other tournaments. And we're going to try and make a statement with this. Whether we stick with it or modify it or go back to a much more traditional tournament when we have more time for 2020 remains to be seen. Although reverting to a more traditional format with an elimination round is certainly something which will be a big part of the discussions going forward.
Yeah, I understand. You know, getting a player like Kopitar into the tournament. You know, and he probably wouldn't otherwise be in the tournament. And I understand exactly that you're going to. You know, this is going to give you the best field. I guess the one thing I wondered, and I asked Gary about this as well, that just. You know, if you do decide that this is a one-off and then you change it back to something more traditional, you know, one of the issues with World Cup / Canada Cup, aside from the unpredictability of when it was going to happen, well, that's it. There was just, there wasn't continuity. And, you know, the reason we're not talking about the World Cup of hockey or whatever it would have been called as something on the calendar is because, you know, it bounced all over the place, right? It just didn't seem to, it never kind of settled into a format and a pattern. If you change it up after one, aren't you kind of falling back into that?
I suppose there's a risk of that, but I tend to view it a little differently, and I'm pretty sure the NHL shares this view, that we'll see what happens with this. We'll look at the long calendar. We'll consider. But we would expect with this tournament and with any other kinds of events that we may eventually agree upon that you will move towards a settled format to create the kind of recurring interest where people understand what's going on that you describe, because there is real value there. Nobody questions that.
We understand a little bit about the economics. We understand this is a partnership between the NHL and the Players Association. We assume there's a an agreement to divide revenues in some way, shape, or form. And we're not going to pry into what those that situation is. I don't know that it's necessarily relevant. The one thing that occurs to me is, are these individual players going to be paid for their participation in this event?
Yes.
So,
and here's what it is. It's really not very simple. There will be expenses. There'll be a net. Nobody knows how much it's going to be. There'll be a division, and the players as a group, all 725 of them, will decide how that's distributed. Same way we did with transition payments.
So the entire union, the entire association will determine how the revenues from this championship or their revenues from this championship will be divided.
That's right.
All right. So, so theoretically, somebody who doesn't play in this event could get as much as somebody who does?
In theory, sure. I think that's very unlikely, though, but in theory, sure.
Okay. Are you 100% on board with the process? What has been determined?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I understand this was a joint venture. I understand that obviously you and Mr. Bettman and various others put this thing together. Are you satisfied that this is going in the direction that you, as the representative of the Players Association, wanted to?
Oh, yeah. And you have to remember, since everything we do has to be mutually agreed upon, if anybody's really aggravated and doesn't want to do something, that they can basically say stop. But whenever you do this, you talk, you consider, you think, you talk to potential partners, you talk to the federations, talk to the players, you talk to everybody there is, and you make a series of judgments as to what the best way through this is. You come to agreements, and then you live with them. You know, it's a pretty straightforward thing.
We thank you very much. Sorry, okay. I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you want to say something else?
No, I said it's a pretty straightforward thing. So if you would ask me the question, you know, when I'm lying in bed at night and thinking about a perfect world, could I imagine something different than this or our current CBA or less snow in Toronto?
Right.
The answer is sure. But that's not the world we live in. And if on a practical basis, is this going in the right direction? Are we fully on board behind it? Do we think it's going to work in the real world? The answer is yes.
Make sure you union guys don't screw it up this time, okay?
Don't. Well, you know, I'll just leave you with one thought, because this tournament's going to break the rule. When I first went to work for Marvin Miller, and if you have listeners that don't know who he was, he's the guy that founded the Baseball Players Association.
That's right.
And basically established sports unions. He said to me, you have to remember that the only time the union's in the news is if there's a problem.
Mm.
So I'm sort of used to that, but this is going to break that rule. We're going to be in the news because there's going to be something really good happening.
We assume that that's going to be the case. We hope that will be the case. Thanks, Don, for your time.
We'll take your hopes. Thanks a lot.
We'll talk again. Don Fear, the executive director of the NHL Players Association. Well, the Toronto Blue Jays played another baseball game today. This is two now, as we march through the spring. Buck Martinez joins us from Florida. How are you, Bucko?
Bob, I'm doing great. You just got done talking to a good friend of mine, Mr. Fear. That sounded good.
Do you have much of a relationship with him when you were playing?
Oh, for years. I was the American League vice president for years.
Right.
Yeah, so I worked with Ian Marvin an awful lot. Does a great job.
Compare Marvin Miller to Don Fear. Similarities, differences?
Totally different. Yeah, totally different. Marvin was our grandfather that was a brilliant lawyer. He was understated. He explained the issues to us very well and allowed us to make the decisions. Don came in as his general counsel,
mm-hmm.
and Don learned an awful lot from Marvin, as he alluded to. But, they were very complimentary. You know, Marvin was a seasoned veteran. He was the Mark Burley of the association. He would sit back and just let everybody swing as hard as they could, and they'd hit weak dribblers.
Yeah. After a couple of decades of strife between the players and the league, there has been labor peace in baseball for two decades.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of a forged relationship or a forced relationship? And let me explain that, the latter part. Mm-hmm. That both sides are afraid to go down that road again.
There's a combination of both, I think. I think nobody wants to go down that road again. I think the game is prospering. Both sides are doing very well. And there aren't too many problems. One of the issues I see down the road is possibly argument over the pension, because obviously players are making so much money now. Pension kind of seems redundant, so that might be an issue down the road, but I don't see anything on the near horizon that will create any kind of problems.
Well, the main change, I guess, Buck, is the owners stopped trying to force a salary cap, and they understood you could grow the business without one, right? And that's that. You know, once you took that off the table, there weren't any more strikes. It's
yeah.
funny.
Yeah, you know, they went down that road with collusion, and they didn't like it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they stopped colluding. Well, maybe not, but well, they probably.
Maybe. Let's talk a little about this ball club. You've been had a chance to be around Russell Martin for a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Are you starting to get a sense of what kind of influence he's going to have, not just on this pitching staff, but on this team in general?
You know, when I had a sense of what he would bring, when I knew him years ago, he comes to play every day. And that's what you want from your leader. He's not very outspoken, obviously. He leads by example, and that's the way most leaders are. Whether it's Evan Longoria or Derek Jeter or George Brett or Hal McCray, most of them are very quiet, but they go about their business in a fashion that makes everybody want to fall in line. Everybody wants to get in lockstep. He's had phenomenal success going to the postseason. And, we know 7 out of 9 years he's been in the postseason. And in this day and age, that's an invaluable character asset, because everybody's making money. Everybody's quite comfortable. And another thing I think that speaks volumes is Johan Santana coming to the Blue Jays. Obviously, he's made more money than he'll ever need. And here he is working hard, running in the outfield, holding two baseballs in the air, trying to get his shoulder to a point where he can compete again. So, you know, the Blue Jays have done enough turnover to make people think this might be a good place to be for a while. And this is what happened in the late 80s and early 90s when Toronto became a destination for free agents.
Buck, for a catcher, so Russ Martin comes into a team. He hasn't caught any of these guys before. I don't think he's caught anybody on the staff before. He's working with young pitchers. He's working with veteran guys, very different styles. Burley's a very different guy to catch than, Marcus Stroman. What, over the course of spring training, would seem to me he's one of the guys that's got a, there's a not a learning curve, because he knows what the position is and what it entails, but kind of learning about his guys. How does that work during the spring?
Well, I mean, it's a real challenge, and Russell was aware of it. You know, the Blue Jays have meetings with their players, and they have a meeting with the general manager and the manager and their position coach. And they'll sit in the meeting and say, how do you like to prepare? What do you want to do this spring? This is what we'd like from you. What would you like from us? And when Russell Martin had that meeting, he said, I'd like to have a meeting with all of the catchers at the end of the day so we can debrief each other about the pitcher they caught that day, the ability to sit down and talk and say, okay, what did you see when you caught him? I didn't get a chance to catch him today. You caught him. Tell me about him. That's invaluable information, just to sit around and chat. And that's one thing, and part of the game that's been missing for a number of years, is the communication between teammates. You just sit down and share information. We used to do it over a couple of beers after the game.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anymore. So Russell has incorporated that into his spring training regimen, and I think that's invaluable.
That idea of the catchers getting together after, is that unusual, or is that the norm?
It is pretty unusual. I think in this day and age, any kind of meeting like that, Stephen, is unusual. And I think what has happened is Russell knows he's got to get up to speed quickly on these guys. You know what a curveball does. You know what a slider does. And you even know what a knuckleball does. But everybody's a little bit different. People, I'll give you an example. Jim Clancy couldn't pitch inside. He just wasn't comfortable doing it. So, I kept telling Ernie Witt, don't ask him to pitch inside. He can't do it. It's going to be counterproductive. So let's work on the outside and let him master that. There are certain things guys can't do. If you go over a scouting report and says that David Ortiz can't handle that inside fastball, well, if your particular pitcher isn't comfortable throwing it there, don't ask him to do it. And I think Russell understands now his job is to make the pitcher absolutely 100% confident in the next pitch he's going to throw, and take away the theory from the pitcher and give him just the assignment of execution. No theory involved for pitchers, whether you're experienced or you're a rookie. I'll take care of the theory behind the play. You take care of the execution.
Yeah, I was intrigued. I was intrigued watching yesterday. We didn't get. I was game today wasn't on TV, but I was watching the game yesterday when Sanchez, you know, was cruising early. Then there's the Donaldson error. Then he doesn't get the call. He thought he had a strikeout. Doesn't get a call. Gets a bit rattled. Gives up the home run. You know, I would think that's part of the Russell Martin Sanchez relationship too. Is when he goes out to the mound and has, you know, a young guy, you know, very little major league experience, gets a bit rattled, maybe loses a bit of faith in his stuff, or, you know, overthrows or something along those lines. It's not just, I would think it's not just the technical part of this, but it's the emotional part of this, right?
You know, 100% correct. It sure is. And you know, he threw that 0-2 curveball to Polanco, and it looked like strike three, and Russell said it caught the corner. And if you notice, Sanchez took a step toward the dugout.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was strike three.
Mm-hmm.
So mentally, he said, okay, strike three, three up, three down, I'm out of the inning. Now he comes back and throws a curveball that's not as good, gets a bloop single, then Donaldson makes the error, and on the first pitch to Alvarez, he hits a home run. So he has not regrouped and refocused after he thought he had thrown strike three. And that's part of the learning process. You can't let one pitch leak into the next pitch, and I think that's what happened.
So the catcher goes out there and says, "What? If you're Russell Martin, what do you say to the kid?"
It's a good strike. Don't worry about it. We'll get him now. You have to get back into your focus like those first two batters where you mowed him down easy.
With Buck Martinez, I want to get back very quickly to Johan Santana.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't make it, if he can't make it back, if his pitching days are over, isn't it quite possible? We won't talk about it. If he gets cut in, you know, in the middle of April, you know, if he stays for extended spring and the Blue Jays sing, he just don't have it anymore, and they say goodbye to him, we probably won't mention him again. But isn't there a potentially significant value in just having him around for the next 4 weeks?
Yes, there is. And you know what? You heard it from Stroman, and you heard it from Hutchinson, and said, man, we got some guys around here that know what they're doing. And certainly Santana is one of those guys. He was never a guy that blew you away with pure velocity or stuff. He pitched with his head and a very good changeup. And I think that's what Alex Anthopoulos is thinking about. If he can get back to being healthy, I'm not concerned about the velocity because he has pitchability. He can make the pitches when he needs to. And, you know, he was getting close to joining the Orioles last year when he ruptured his Achilles tendon.
Right.
And he told me a couple days ago, he said it was the worst pain he had ever experienced. So now this speaks about his character once again. He just went through the worst pain he'd ever experienced last year, the disappointment of having a failed rehab, and now he's back in camp trying to do it again. This guy's got exactly what you're looking for, and you keep your fingers crossed that he can have an impact on this team.
Yeah, have you seen him throw?
I've seen him throw. He's playing catch. He's not.
He's just playing catch right now, right? Okay.
Yeah.
But he's
still not extending his shoulder, and right now it's just a matter of playing catch, and nobody should ever get concerned about what he looks like right now.
Gotcha.
But he's also, you know, back on a minor league deal, which tells you something as well, right? That he's, you know, I think he kind of wants to prove, and again, I don't, you know, if it doesn't work out, I get the sense he'll be okay with that if that's the end of the road, but, you know.
Absolutely. He tried last year, and it wasn't his arm, it was his leg. He told me when he pitched in winter ball that it was a rainy, dreary night. He got up, he got loose, he sat down. They didn't know if they were going to play. He said, it just wasn't a good night, and my shoulder got stiff. Well, that's going to happen to a guy that's 100% healthy.
Yeah.
And it was in the playoffs. So, you know, you two guys know how competitive the playoffs are. So they're not going to say, hey, Johan, we'll give you another start in a couple of days. That wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's all about winning at that time, and he didn't have another opportunity to go to the mound.
In general, have you learned anything in the 2 or 3 days of, you know, well, now 2 days of games and, you know, about a week or 10 days or so of these guys being there? Anything jumped out at you?
Yeah, I have learned that there are some good arms in the bullpen competition. Bull Schultz through today, he's got a good arm. Gilmet, there's some guys that are going to open up some eyes. There are strike throwers. I've also learned that center field is going to be a tremendous competition.
Was it ever?
Dalton Pompey had two more hits again today. Pillar threw out a guy at second base. And you know what? Kevin Pillar has always battled the odds. 32nd round pick, comes from a Division II school in California. All he's done is hit. Randy St. Clair told me today He said, he's the kind of guy you watch for a day or two and you slough him off. You watch him for a month and you say, man, that guy's a good player. He does a lot of things to help us win. And I've seen that from Pillar. I think you're going to fall in love with this guy the more you see him play. And he's not pretty. And he doesn't really wow you with anything he does, but the overall package has a lot of intangibles that will help you win.
Well, I guess, and the other thing is with the Saunders injury, which is not obviously not as bad as it looked at, but it's Pillar is going to get, even worst case, he's going to get 2 or 3 weeks with the team to showcase himself, right? He's going to be playing. He'll be playing left field if he's not playing in center field.
Yeah, you know what, Steven? That's important, too. And I think the problem that Pillar has had, he knows that he has to prove himself. And he's trying to hit every pitch that he sees. And he has swung. You've seen this. He's swung at pitches mm-hmm. that have bounced in the opposite batter's box mm-hmm. in the big leagues. And once you show pitchers you're going to swing at that pitch, that's all you're going to get.
Yep.
So he has to make the adjustments again, a little more plate discipline. He's been a 321 hitter throughout the minor leagues. Wherever he's gone, he's hit. He had an extended historic hitting streak in college. And, I mean, this guy can hit. He's kind of like Hunter Pence. You look at him and you go, ooh, that's pretty ugly. And he ended up with a three-hit night and threw out a guy at second.
Yeah.
That's the kind of player I think Kevin Pillar is.
Buckle, we could talk all night, but we got to go. You got things to do. Enjoy your evening, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks a lot for this.
Good to be with you guys.
Buck Martinez from Florida. When we come back, the Bills make waves. Jerry Sullivan of the Buffalo News, even he was surprised. We'll talk to him when Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Before the hour, McCowan and Brunt on Primetime. Is there a league where trades are more rare than the National Football League?
Well, trade football trades, like real trades.
Like real trades.
Yeah. Well, it's getting pretty rare all over the place, aren't they?
I guess they are.
Yeah.
Just seems to me that they're very rare in the National Football League, but we had a football trade. I mean, it has cap implications, and almost all deals these days have cap implications, but that was a pretty interesting football trade. The Buffalo Bills acquire LeSean McCoy from the Eagles for linebacker Kiko Alonso. Two pretty good football players. Alonso, a really good young talent. But in McCoy, the Bills get one of the top five for sure running backs in the National Football League.
Coming off a slightly off year, but yeah.
Jerry Sullivan of the Buffalo News is, I can't think of anybody else you'd go to talk about the Buffalo Bills situation. Did this one catch you?
If I knew you guys gave a forum to Zeisberger, I might have reconsidered.
Yeah, I know. I understand what you're saying, Jerry.
Desperate days, desperate measures, those kinds of things.
I'm sick enough to consider him a civic treasure up there. He's a dear friend of mine for years, but that we don't need to dwell on that.
Did this one catch you by surprise?
It did. I did something recently. I actually did some research. There were 10 rookie running backs last year who gained more than the Bills' leading rusher. And my point, of course, was it's easy to get these guys. It's considered one of the more replaceable positions in the league. So I thought and was told by people close to the team they would get one of the draft and use Fred and the other guys and do it by committee and spend their money elsewhere. I guess when McCoy became available and they decided not to overpay Hughes at linebacker, they said, you know what, if we're going to ground and pound, how about a guy that ran the ball 300 times each of the last 2 years and had the second most running most yards in the NFL? So they jumped at it, and I think it makes them better.
I guess, but the beginning of this has to be was when they decided that the C.J. Spiller ship had sailed, right? That they weren't going to.
That sailed in October. Really no question, no chance he was coming back. They didn't want him. I don't think he wanted to be there, despite whatever he says to the contrary. And as I wrote, this is a bigger, tougher, more durable version of Spiller, but with some of the same, you know, shortcomings. He's had some criticism for running sideways and not hitting the hole fast enough. But it's hard to argue with the numbers he put up the last 2 years. The thing is, guys, it's fashionable to trash the running back position. No one's worth it. You know, Murray, DeMarco Murray's a free agent, and this is probably bad news to him to see, you know, the second best guy statistically go for, you know, a linebacker who's been injured for a year. People don't want to pay for them. So you can criticize the Bills for throwing $10 million onto their cap this year for a running back. They always seem to be behind the curve on the running back position. They've drafted more first-round running backs than any other team in the league over the last, well, go back to McGahee. Would that be 14 years, 12 mm-hmm. years? So they seem to want to continue to believe that it's a very important position. I'm not saying it isn't, but that's their profile. And here they go. They will probably be paying more for their featured back than any team in the league this year. But you have a coach now who is kind of a throwback too, who wants to win with ground and pound and great defense and prove it can still be done in the league. So it's going to be a fascinating year to find out if Rex Ryan can win that way.
Although they drafted, you know, it's not like their draft record was terrible in the guys they picked, right? They didn't. It wasn't like Trent Richardson, right? They did draft some
right.
guys. Marshawn Lynch had a pretty good career, right? Yeah.
Yeah. The problem was they never had the quarterback, and they didn't have a team that made those guys very excited to live in Buffalo, where they couldn't find a club to their liking. Spiller was a different story, but that was the worst of them all because after they tried it so many times, they drafted or ninth overall when they had Marshawn Lynch and Fred Jackson.
Yeah.
That was crazy. So they're still paying for that in a sense. And so now they also picked up a quarterback today, guys, in Castle.
Yes.
So they're running through the seventh round of the 2005 draft because he, like Fitzpatrick, was drafted in the seventh round of the 2005 draft at exactly the same age, the exact same quarterback rating. So this is basically Fitz coming back without the running ability. So.
Well, couldn't you make the case here, Jerry, that if this starts with who's our quarterback going to be and how good is he going to be? And if we don't have one of those, we damn well better have a running back who can move the football.
Well, absolutely, especially when they don't like what's out there and they don't want to make a crazy deal that will have them paying $17, $18 million to Cutler or paying for Bradford. There's an element in there, and Whaley mainly, who still want to believe that E.J. Manuel can be a franchise quarterback. They invested a lot in him. They drafted the pick for one thing, then the trade for Watkins, a ridiculous deal to surround him with more talent. And so I think they want him to succeed, and so they're not going to bring in a guy who's going to be a huge threat to him. But doesn't this sound familiar? Sounds like the same thing they've done the last 2 years.
Yeah.
So are we going to look at the same thing 4 games into the season if E.J. wins the job over Castle, where it's like, hey, he's struggling, he's not hitting receivers, Rex Ryan wants to win right away, there's pressure to win with this defense, and they do the same thing. Then they throw in Castle, and, you know, he's average, and there you go. And it gets back to the same question. Can you win nowadays with a mediocre starting quarterback in the NFL?
Well, and Castle's who you get when you fail to sign Josh McCown, right? So he's the alternative.
Yeah, think
to that.
About that, Josh McCown. They're really despairing because they did get Josh McCown.
Yeah, if I had to ask you to bet right now, Jerry, who's the presumptive starting quarterback of the Buffalo Bills going into this season? Who would you put your money on?
Oh God, I would put it on Castle.
Yeah,
based on merit, you know, and I think that's got to be the way it's going to be. I think what happened yesterday shows, and I'm getting criticized by some people. But this shows this is Rex Ryan's operation. You know, they're singing Kumbaya, and he and Whaley are working together, and it's not like Philly. You know, the guy in Philly that made that deal yesterday won a power struggle, and he's a coach with total control over personnel. Technically, Ryan doesn't have that, and they want everybody to be happy. But when he goes and gets a running back and pays him $10 million and decides that I think it's Ryan that decided they didn't not to pay Jerry Hughes, this is Rex Ryan. And, I mean, it should be. The reason everyone's excited is because they've got a big-timer now. He's the big boy, Rex Ryan. Whatever happened at the end of the Jets, he's a major name in the league that restored credibility there. And let's remember, Doug Whaley was a disempowered figure when they were going to bring in Polian, and we thought he might lose his job. So if you think that those two are equal in power in the NFL, then you're a little naive, in my opinion.
But it's
Rex
kinda...
Ryan is going to do it his way, and he's going to go up, and he said it at his opening press conference. You know, he knows this is his last shot. He's going to do it his way, and we'll find out. I think he thinks he can win with the guys in this defense, and he doesn't think he needed Hughes. He's going to go get this guy Harris, probably, that he had with the Jets. I think he really thinks he could have a dominant defense. Am I rambling here? Yes. The same type of defense he had when he went to the Jets. And you know what he did with the Jets his first year? Led the NFL in rushing attempts and rushing yards.
Yep.
And he had a guy named Thomas Jones, 330 carries for 1,400 yards. He wants McCoy to be his Thomas Jones.
Well, he also got the AFC Championship game with Mark Sanchez playing quarterback.
Right. Now, so, can that be reproduced? The people around the league think of that as like winning the Super Bowl with, what's his name?
Trent Dilfer?
Dilfer. Or Brad Johnson, who I thought was a pretty accomplished passer, that you can do it. And hey, Russell Wilson, I think, is a star, but he wasn't exactly, he wasn't Peyton Manning last year when he won the Super Bowl. They won it with defense. Everyone kind of now wants to emulate what they did with defensive backs. So it's always shifting the NFL. We are in an age of quarterbacks, but there are people watching. And they want to see if in 2015 that it can work this way. And if everything goes right, I mean, they can make a run. They were 9-7 last year.
See, there's a lot of things to like about this team, though, Jerry. And, you know, and although Kiko Alonso coming back would have been one of them. But a lot of things to like about the defense. Sammy Watkins is an electric football player. There's a lot of stuff. But, you know, for anybody who maybe isn't Rex Ryan, the minute you add, say, and the quarterback is going to be Matt Castle, or the quarterback is going to be EJ Manuel, kind of takes, you know, it kind of dulls that enthusiasm a bit, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, when you look around the league over the last 10 years and the teams that have made title games, you don't see Matt Castle there.
No.
You see Brady a lot. I mean, the amazing thing is Brady's always there, and teams with quarterbacks get there. You got a young guy like a Colin Kaepernick, you get there but look what they had. They built that team around defense and a power run game, and he just had to make some plays. So it can work, but you really got to be sure you got all the other elements. And guess what they also have? They have the guy who was the offensive coordinator for San Francisco. He believes in this power running game too, Greg Roman. I think they're going to make some other additions. They'll probably get a tight end. I wouldn't be surprised to see if they went after another lineman like this guy Upati from the 49ers to fill this thing in. And what makes it all possible is that you're not paying $20 million for a quarterback. They're going to pay $4.7 for Castle, and they're not paying much for Manuel. That allows you to fill in other places. Of course, you could say that about any team with a bad quarterback. I mean, you've got to really put a lot of other pieces together. And you talk about the defense. I agree with you. And you know what? The defense was significantly better without Kiko Alonso last year. That was part of this. They gave up significantly fewer long plays than they did with Kiko Alonso. In the second half of his rookie season, although he made a lot of plays that we're watching on ESPN, he was out of position a lot, and they got burned a lot. He wasn't the only reason, but the fact is, I don't think they thought they were going to miss him because they didn't miss him last year, and he's coming off a major injury.
Yeah, it's an ongoing story, but we'll have to cut this off because we're out of time. Thank you, as always, Mr. Sullivan, and we will speak to you again soon, I assume.
I'm always here for you.
Thanks, pal. Jerry Sullivan of the Buffalo News. It's a very interesting deal predicated on the principle that we don't have a great quarterback, so we better have a great running game. And will they? Well, they got a guy who's capable of being pretty good.
Big draft mistakes kill you. EJ Manuel.
I get it, but how do you solve the problem?
Well,
put a Band-Aid on it for now.
Well, I guess. You know, or you go out and trade for make a deal for Sam Bradford, who's got more of an upside than this guy does.
Hope you got a field goal kicker and kick a long one and you win 3-0 every week.
Yeah, doesn't happen much anymore.
No, I get it. I'm not optimistic, but I at least understand the theory. And a lot of times with things that happen with the Buffalo Bills, I don't even understand the theory. Our thanks to Jerry Sullivan, Buck Martinez, Don Fear for joining us on the program, to Gary Bettman earlier. For Brent McCowan, I'm gone for a week. I think Blair's in here.
Yes.
See you soon.